Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. The Syrian refugee crisis has once again grabbed headlines in this election campaign after reports the Prime Minister's office played a role in vetting some refugee claims and gave preferential treatment based on religion. The Conservatives deny that this is the case. To discuss it more, I'm joined by a representative from the Syrian Canadian Council. The Thanksgiving weekend is here, and it will be a key moment in this election, since pollsters say it's when many Canadians will be making the decision who to vote for. But before we eat turkey dinner, the three major party leaders made sure to release their full platforms. To talk more about this, we're joined by pollster Nick Nanos and McLean's associate editor Aaron Wary. After Thanksgiving is over, we'll be in the final week of the campaign. So what will the parties have to do in these crucial days? The McLean's panel weighs in. And finally, from sign vandalism to robocalls, candidates and Canadians have made around 400 official complaints, and that number is expected to rise dramatically. We speak with the chief investigator for the Commissioner of Canada Elections. For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. The Syrian refugee crisis has hit the campaign trail again in a big way after reports raised some concerns about the actions of the Prime Minister's office in the spring. On Thursday, the Globe and Mail first reported that the government had halted the processing of government-assisted refugee claims due to an audit of that process. Immigration officials say that was to ensure the integrity of the system and that the appropriate security measures were in place. But the Globe also reported that it was the Prime Minister's office that had called for that audit, not bureaucrats, and that the staff in the PMO wanted to vet some of the UN refugee applications. Conservative leader Stephen Harper disputed that claim later in the day.
Our government has adopted a generous approach to the admission of refugees while ensuring the selection of the most vulnerable people and keeping our country safe and secure. The audit we asked for earlier this year was to ensure that these policy objectives are being met. Political staff are never involved in approving refugee applications. Such decisions are made by officials in the Department of Citizenship and Immigration.
But on Friday, there were more reports about this issue. Post Media said this audit was not just about security, it also examined whether Christians and other vulnerable groups were getting priority status. The Globe then said that the government was triaging these refugee claims using a set of criteria such as their religion, the age of the children, and whether or not they had a business background. Then CTV cited sources who told them staff from the Prime Minister's office did go through the files to make sure that persecuted religious minorities were being accepted, specifically ones the Prime Minister could court for votes. Insiders also tell CTV the PMO was actively discouraging the Immigration Department from accepting any applications from Shia and Sunni Muslims. Once again, Harper was forced to address the issue at a campaign stop.
Let's be very clear, the vulnerable ethnic and religious minorities that are being targeted for slaughter by ISIS and its allies are not exclusively Christian by any means. That includes Muslim minorities as well and other groups. But in the end, as we've been very clear, we don't make the decisions on refugee selection. They're not made by political people. Those decisions are made by arm's length bureaucrats under the policy.
Conservative opponents didn't hold back, like Liberal leader Justin Trudeau.
Staffers were pouring through their personal files to try and see whether these families or find out which families would be suitable for a photo op for the Prime Minister's re-election campaign. That's disgusting.
The NDP's Thomas Mulcair also made some scathing remarks.
I've spent a lifetime fighting to build bridges between linguistic, ethnic, and religious groups. Mr. Harper spent his lifetime burning those bridges.
Now, I will point out, I did ask for a Conservative candidate to join me on the show, but I was told one was not available. So to speak more about this, I'm joined by Faisal Alazam, a spokesperson with the Syrian Canadian Council. What's your reaction after hearing the news and hearing the government say that that's not the case?
It's shock and unfortunately a confirmation of a lot of fears that we've been having as the Syrian Canadians and as well as the Canadians that were very disturbed by the development of events in Syria. Having our government choose from files referred by the UNHCR, which are vulnerable cases of Syrian refugees these refugees had to wait a very long time to be interviewed by the UNHCR and to be selected. And now suddenly going through another filter made by the government so that they can choose the ones that they feel are the most ideologically acceptable for them. You know, this is something that's very disturbing. Unfortunately, you cannot say and we cannot claim that we have a humanitarian approach anymore in terms of Syria when we focus on the protection of a certain group that complies to our ideological preferences and ignore other groups purposely. So we have a big issue. And the other point as well that was disturbing is that the economical factor is taking into consideration the business history, how well these people and these refugees were doing. So this actually goes completely against the whole idea of saving and protecting people from persecution. This Syria file has been extremely frustrating and very ugly. And unfortunately, new layers of ugliness have been added and just added to the frustration that we've been feeling for quite a bit of time.
You mentioned at the start of your answer that this confirmed fears. How long have you been having fears? What have you noticed in the past? What were your fears?
Well, the fears are choosing and picking refugees. The fears are pushing purposely sponsorships to go on the private sector, because we know that the majority of organizations with agreements with the government are church groups. And we know that since January, over 90% of Syrian refugees that made it to Canada, 90% of Syrian refugees that made it to Canada were actually from religious minorities, and only 5% resettled by the government, if you want, were minorities. So clearly the files referred by the UNHCR is a reflection of the demography of Syria. So majority are Muslims, and then you have that minority as well that needs protection. But it seems that in the vision of the government, that's not enough. So in the private sector, they didn't intervene because they knew that, you know, because churches are the ones doing the sponsoring, the majority are going to come from minorities. But the worry and the intervention came from the UNHCR files, because when the UNHCR selects the refugees, it doesn't take into consideration religion or ethnicity.
So when you say churches, do you mean Christian churches, or are you talking about places of worship in general?
It's places in worship of general, but two-thirds of the sponsorship agreement holders are Christian churches in Canada. And the list is actually published on the government's website, on the CIC website.
But with those who have come over here as a part of these refugee claims, have you noticed a lack of Sunni and Shia Muslims?
I have, unfortunately, and I hate to speak about these issues because I see Syrians as Syrians and human beings as human beings that require protection. However, it's very hard not to notice that there are specific groups that are being protected and others that are extremely vulnerable and referred by the United Nations requiring protection that are not getting here, because suddenly our government decides that these people don't deserve or should not be protected.
What do you think should happen after hearing about all of this?
I'm actually favorable of an inquiry to understand how partisan staff in the Prime Minister's office are interfering and selecting files of refugees and interfering in the work of public servants. People that don't have experience in security, because we have bodies for that, including the RCMP, CSIS, etc., and don't have the refugee background experience. So it's a bit strange, and I think it's probably a first in recent Canadian history.
Do you have any family yourself in Syria, or anybody trying to escape Syria?
So I have a lot of friends. So majority of my family left and are around Syria. But a lot of friends are still in Syria and unable to even leave Syria, because, as you know, Lebanon and Jordan closed their borders. And it's very tricky to travel to Turkey. You have a lot of checkpoints to pass to. So in a sense, you're witnessing a, you know, genocide. And I don't think I'm exaggerating by using this word in front of you.
How does it make you feel then, personally, when you...
Right now, a lot of frustration, and there is anger as well, because a lot of things could have been avoided, because, you know, this is not something new. It's been 4.5 years. I personally testified in the Foreign Affairs Committee in 2012 to warn Parliament and to warn the government that this refugee crisis is extremely serious and we need to do something about it here in Canada. And Syrian Canadians are literally losing family members because they're unable to reunite with them here in Canada. Visa officers are systematically refusing their visas, telling them, well, you haven't convinced me that you will leave Canada at the end of your visa. And it's not something new. They know very well about it. It is a political decision to delay it, to put obstacles, to make it hard. It took that little boy to drown and to die to finally, and maybe Europe's tranquility to be disturbed, to finally mobilize us. And we need to keep this mobilization.
That was Faisal Al-Azam, a spokesperson with the Syrian Canadian Council. Once again, I did ask for a conservative to join us on the show, but one was not available. Still to come, pollster Nick Nanos explains why Thanksgiving is a crucial moment in the campaign. McLean's associate editor Aaron Wary looks at the platform dump from the parties. The McLean's panel discusses the home stretch of the campaign, and we find out how many complaints have been filed during this election. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Coming up on the show, we talk platform politics with Aaron Wary. The McLean's panel talks about what the leaders need to do in the final days of the campaign, and we look at the official complaints that Canadians and candidates have been filing during this election. But first, Elections Canada has set up its advanced polling stations across the country, so if you know who you want to vote for, you can cast your ballot now. But if you still don't know who you want to support on Election Day, the Thanksgiving weekend could end up being one of the most important moments of this whole campaign. The reason for that is that the conversations you have over turkey dinner with the ones you love will help many Canadians either firm up their vote or switch it. To delve deeper into this Thanksgiving matter, McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaks with pollster Nick Nanos from Nanos Research.
What's your take? If you're saying to people to try to frame the importance of the Thanksgiving weekend sitting at this point in the campaign, how do you see it?
Well, you know, so first of all, any holiday weekend during a campaign usually is one of the key decision points because that's when family and friends get together. And they talk not only about what's happening at the national level, but they talk about what's happening where they live. And the coincidental placement of Thanksgiving weekend the week before the election makes it a killer weekend because any trend coming out of Thanksgiving is going to be hard to reverse for a campaign. Because there's not enough time. The reality is, if you were doing an ad buy, this week would be the best week to do the ad buy because by next week, people will have already spoken to their neighbors and their family and their friends about the campaign.
When by this week, you mean the week leading up to the Thanksgiving weekend would be the best week.
Where we are right now.
Yeah, where we are right now.
Yeah.
Get your opinion out there and make it part of the conversation on the weekend and then...
Exactly. You know, because the whole idea behind, you know... The whole idea behind effective advertising is to target it at kind of point of decision. And yes, there will be people deciding later next week, but there are people probably be deciding this weekend. And I would probably add another level of complexity in that this weekend there will be discussions about who is the main challenger to Stephen Harper, which is really, you know, the first 60-odd days of the campaign, it actually hasn't been between the Conservatives, the Liberals, and the New Democrats. The reality has been the first 66 or 67 days of the campaign has been about sorting through who is the challenger.
And that's basically, let's not beat around the bush, that's basically
the Liberals
seem to
right
want
now.
That, right?
Yeah.
And does that timing, the fact that sense seems to have crystallized in the last few days or week or so, does that mean that the Liberals must be hoping this Thanksgiving weekend becomes a kind of accelerator on that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
They have to hope that it's a tipping point in terms of, because what will happen is for those Canadians that are not part of the Harper universe, the Liberals have to hope that they kick the tires on the red car and decide to opt for Justin Trudeau.
Do you think it's wise of the parties to campaign full out over the weekend? I know there's differing opinions in the strategists I've talked to about how to handle it. You want your message out there, but I guess you don't want to be annoying people when they feel like they're supposed to be having a break. How would you calibrate that, Nick?
Well, you know, I would say that anything on social media would be an unrestricted opportunity because people go to social media. Right? Mm. It's not as if social media is pushed on them part of their experience because they can turn Twitter off.
That was Nick Nanos from Nanos Research discussing the Thanksgiving weekend and how it will affect your vote. So we know this is a big decision weekend for Canadians, but what have the parties been doing to try and sway those turkey-loving swing voters? Well, they've released their full party platforms. The Liberals kicked it all off on Monday, then on Friday we got the platforms of the NDP and the Conservatives. And to talk more about platform politics, I'm joined now by Maclean's associate editor, Aaron Wary. So Aaron, thank you very much for joining me from Montreal, where you're at the NDP platform release. I guess my first question would be, what's the point of releasing a platform? Will any real voters actually read any of the platforms that were released this week from the Liberals, the Conservatives, and the NDP?
I suppose we have to allow for the possibility that there are people who are out there who are undecided, who are looking for more information, who are going to look these documents up and flip through it or try to find specific ideas or promises that appeal to them or look at specific issues that appeal to them and maybe even comparison shop. But it's, you know, at this point in the campaign, most of the promises that were in these platforms have already been made. There's not a lot of major surprises. There's maybe little things here and there that are kind of interesting. What this really is, I think the best way to look at platform launches at this point is that they're basically opportunities for the parties to set the narrative and the agenda for a day or two or 3 days. They get to go out and say, here's our platform, and then, you know, the media will pick that up and report it. And, it's another chance for the parties to kind of market themselves.
Is it also a chance for candidates to maybe, when they're hitting different doors, going door knocking, and they get those questions on, you know, what's your party policy on this or that, that they have something there to open up and point to?
Yeah, there's definitely going to be some of that, you know, sort of filtering down to the riding level and packaging it so that they can sort of present specific plans. But again, it's really hard to tell sort of how that really translates, whether the public kind of really gets into the details of these things or whether they're, you know, I guess one way to look at it is, you know, a political party could never not release a platform, could never not release a full costing. At this point, you kind of need to do those things. They're sort of prerequisites. So there's an interesting debate sort of in academic circles about how much even policy matters in any election and whether people are particularly interested in the specific ideas and the details and how the policies are built or whether the policies sort of translate to people in terms of principles and values and emphasis. So if the party is talking about the environment, does that appeal to people more than, you know, the specific policy that they're proposing?
Is a platform release also a chance for these parties to sort of get out there and say, address some of the issues that haven't been some of the headline issues that they've been dealing with on the campaign trail?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, the NDP has not really talked a lot about democratic reform during this election, at least to my memory, but yet when they put this platform out, you know, there's a whole section on democratic reform, so that kind of fills out that picture. You can definitely, even if the parties want to focus on, you know, three or four major ideas, major priorities, the platform is this sort of comprehensive document that lays out, you know, 100 priorities. So particularly interested in one of those five priorities, but you also have some interest in other things. You can look to the platform and sort of find those other things. You know, in for my own particular case, like I'm always interested to see what parties propose on parliamentary reform, and so you know but the only real discussion of that in this election has been within the platform. So they are valuable documents in that sense. But like I said, it's hard to know whether, you know, that everyone this weekend is going to print these documents off the internet and sit around a dining room table sort of, you know, comparing and contrasting and writing up reviews of them.
All right, so let's talk about that a little bit. Is the timing of this to align with Thanksgiving weekend to try and sway voters just before that point?
I imagine so, yeah. I imagine this is a big chance to appeal to people and to set your agenda and put your ideas out there and make your comprehensive offer going into this weekend. Not that next week isn't going to be important, not that, you know, there isn't going to be still, you know, debate and movement, but this weekend is kind of that last sort of deep breath before the election. And it seems a bit almost cliche that, like, people would, you know, gather around the Thanksgiving dinner table and hash out politics, but it is a thing that's going to come up in discussion in every household this weekend, or most households this weekend, and it may, you know, settle some things. People may make decisions this weekend about which way they're going to go. And if the electorate is as flexible and as sort of undecided as it has seemed to be, that could result in some pretty significant shifts. It could either change the way the trends are going, or it could sort of cement the trends that we've seen.
That was McLean's associate editor Aaron Wary discussing the politics of the party platform releases. Still to come, the McLean's panel discusses the home stretch of the campaign and breaks down what the party leaders have to do. And we speak with an investigator about the official complaints being made in this campaign. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Still to come on the show, we take a look at the official complaints that Canadians and candidates have been making in this election. But first,
it's now time for the McLean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined by McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes and McLean's political editor Paul Wells. Thanks very much for joining us, guys.
Great to be here.
All right, so we're going to be entering after this weekend the final week of the campaign. It's the home stretch. John, I'll start with you. What do the parties need to do in these final days of campaigning?
Well, I mean, if you go down the list, I guess the hardest tasks is Tom Mulcair's, because he has to change the trend line that has gone into the final week. That's the hardest thing of all to do. He's got to reverse the trend line. It's not like he's had a disastrous campaign. Eh? It's been just a sort of steady erosion of his position rather than him falling off a cliff at some point, eh? Which must be awfully frustrating for them. So I think he's got to somehow change the channel. People I've spoken with think that maybe this is getting turned a bit of a myth. I don't know what you think, Paul, but people think that there'll be a firming up of decisions over the long weekend. You know, they people think that happened at the Christmas break in the 2005-06 election. So I guess for him, toughest thing is that for the Prime Minister, it's shifting people to a kind of cautious mode. He's tried to get people thinking cautiously through the whole campaign. He thinks that's what works for him. And I guess for Justin Trudeau, I think it's focusing on where there are big blocks of seats. Just remember, the Liberals have very few seats in the House right now. He has to win bushels of seats to have this be a good day for him. I think that means Ontario, and particularly the ring of seats around Toronto.
All right, Paul, what do you think the parties need to do?
I'm a great believer in the mystery of Thanksgiving weekend, the Canadians getting together over some turkey. And it turns out, we've seen it now in several recent elections, they talk about politics. It was over Thanksgiving weekend that the Liberals in 2008 lost a lot of their support, and it was over the Christmas holiday in 2005-2006 that a chunk of the electorate decided they had had enough of the Liberals and it was time for a change. So how that will play this Thanksgiving weekend, I'll tell you on October 20th how it played. But I think that this introduces a different kind of dynamic into the campaign, people getting together and kind of mulling things over. And unless Canadians are planning to solve, figure out what Putin is trying to accomplish in Syria over Thanksgiving, I think they're not going to have much else to talk about except this election.
And the Jays.
And where do you think the party leaders will be campaigning? Where do you think the focus is going to be? I think John touched on the GTA and other areas where the Liberals really want to build up some seats.
Greater Toronto is obviously key. Things are starting to get interesting in Quebec, though. First of all, in the sense that the Liberals seem to have begun some kind of pretty serious breakthrough in Quebec and will want to extend it outside of Anglophone West Montreal and the Gatineau region and try and carry that bandwagon to the rest of Quebec. And the other parties are going to want to try and protect and consolidate. Quebec is turning into a four-way race, including the Bloc. And that's a bit of a surprise. So I think there'll be a little bit of a few more incursions into the 819, 514 than there otherwise would have been.
Hmm. How do you think the campaigns are going into this week? Do you think anybody's losing steam? Are they just as strong as they were before?
You know, it's tempting to want to declare that something dramatic has happened. But my sense is that what we've really seen is more a gradual trend lines emerging in this campaign that maybe get accelerated here at the end. But the trends have been fairly consistent, right? I mean, the Conservatives rebounded at a point when people thought that they were in trouble. And it was after the Syrian refugee crisis became a prominent matter. The Liberals have steadily built through the campaign from what I can see. And the NDP have never quite managed to get traction. That's the way I see it. So the question becomes whether or not in the final days, Canadians, let's say that Paul's right in there mulling it over pumpkin pie, and you decide, you know, if you're a throw Harper out kind of voter, do you decide, you know what, I think if we go with the Liberals now because they look like they've got the best chance. This is the nightmare scenario for New Democrats. They've seen versions of this happening in campaigns before. That could happen over this weekend, or it could be that depending on how, I don't know. I mean, John, Paul, how do you think Harper's done the last few days? I'm trying to figure out whether or not, you know, him pitching it as a campaign about what? About kind of more values now than economics? Does that work, or is it?
I think they're trying to find a channel. I'm starting to think the Conservatives are genuinely worried. They put an ad out on Friday where they said, where you've got Harper's voice saying, this election isn't about me, it's not a popularity contest, it's about you. That means he's losing the popularity contest.
Yeah, yeah.
And values, which essentially means fear about radical Islam, works in some parts of the country but not in others. And the economy is not as strong a message as it was. I still think there's a very good chance that the Conservatives win this. But Harper's not sounding as confident as he had.
On the economy thing, you know, if we went back to near the start of the campaign, you could find recitations from all of the party's strategists saying, oh, it'll ultimately be about the economy, it'll ultimately be about the economy. The economy hasn't exactly cooperated with that because, first of all, it has neither been robustly strong. So you could say, wow, look, we're in a strong recovery phase. We better keep the guys in power who are there right now. Nor has it been, looking dangerously like we're sinking back in recession. It's been a very middling economy, and that's a hard thing for any party to make the central issue. People just are neither really enthusiastic nor very concerned right now. It's a holding pattern economy that doesn't lead into any kind of election narrative that anyone can make. So I think we've seen the focus shift elsewhere to the value stuff, which I guess means kneecaps and refugees, to something else that I know this drives New Democrats and Conservatives wild. But Justin Trudeau has outperformed the worst predictions of how he would stumble and fall and look weak in a campaign. And he has met the expectations of Liberals who are saying he makes people feel good. When he goes out, people feel good about Justin. And I think they do. If you're out on the campaign trail watching him perform, people seem to get a kick out of him. His TV ads are kind of, even when they're not trying to be, they seem somewhat lighthearted, you know, going up the escalator and all that kind of thing. This is an intangible factor that I think, given the lack of any other galvanizing thing to change minds, is a difficult thing for people to battle back against. If people are watching him thinking, oh, I kind of like him, oh, he kind of makes me feel good, boy, that's a hard factor, I think, to be in opposition to.
All right. One thing that popped up when the NDP released their platform was the issue of coalitions again. It's popped up in this campaign. It's popped up before. It's been used to warn against the opposition parties by the Conservatives. And now the NDP says, hey, we'll work with any Federalist party that basically wants to take down Harper. How do you think the coalition factor is going to play into this in the final days, Paul?
The language of the NDP commitment is kind of extraordinary. It says, yes, they'll work with any Federalist Party, either temporarily or in appropriate alliances to end the Harper decade. I mean, that is a campaign pledge to seek a coalition with another Federalist Party. And unless Elizabeth May and the Green Party do way better than I'm expecting, Mulcair now has put in his platform a promise to seek parliamentary arrangements with the Liberals to end the Harper years. That's, I think, the beginning of some pretty serious horse trading that would ensue after a vote if no party has a majority.
There's a factor there, eh? And one of the reasons that I think Tom Mulcair can say that is because for insiders in the NDP who believe in precedent in a way, the fact that they've pushed for that under Jack Layton's leadership in 2008 has made it an acceptable doctrine, right? I'm not talking about rank and file New Democrats out there who I think are going to be confused by that message, but for insiders who Mulcair has to look in the face as he does his job, he's essentially reaffirming what was kind of the doctrine of that last coalition effort. So he's inoculated in a way against that somehow being heresy, you know?
But would the Liberals even want to do this if the seat projections are correct and we do end up with a Conservative government, a minority one? Maybe Harper doesn't stay around and there could be an opening in just a year's time. Would they want to take that risk if it's not palatable to voters?
Are you, Cormac, are you getting at the idea that it'd be better to let a minority Conservative government rule somehow and live to fight another day without having to
the next election down the line?
Well, that's a pretty interesting tactical consideration. I'm not saying that might not come into people's minds, but I think the urge to be in power is a powerful urge, you know? And if you've got a path to being in power, to having the Prime Minister be Justin Trudeau, then I suspect you'd take it. What do you think?
I just think all these things are going to be very path dependent, as we say in science, that it will depend not just on numbers. People say how many seats do the Conservatives lead?
Right.
It's going to depend on whether the specific members elected look like a viable cabinet in the Liberal or the NDP caucus. It'll have a lot to do with the tone of Mulcair and Trudeau towards each other, whether Harper can identify Liberal or NDP MPs who might be amenable to jumping ship. I mean, it'll be if it ain't a mess, it'll do till a mess gets here. You know, there's nothing you can just sort of say. There's a threshold, and beyond that, so and so is safe or so and so can't govern. It'll really depend on what tools are available to each of the leaders after election night.
And John, I wanted to talk to you as well about the ethnic vote. You've been writing on this recently. How is this going to play into the campaign? I mean, obviously, with the issue of the niqab popping up and other things with refugees, it seems like it's going to be quite significant.
Yeah, and let's remember that one of the central narrative lines about the Conservative coalition was that the Tories had won ethnic communities. The Prime Minister boasted in an interview last year that they were the majority party with most of these communities now. Most of the analysis I've seen has shown that there's some truth to it. The Conservatives did much better among first-generation, second-generation Canadians in the last election than they had done previously. In fact, they built over a few campaigns towards that. There are two factors to look at there, though. One is ethnic communities are different. They did very well with East Asians, for example, but never very well with South Asians. They've never done well with Muslims. They've done very well with immigrants from Europe. So there's different categories. But even if you take all immigrants as a group, the most striking thing in the most recent analysis of numbers is that they tend to move the way, dare I say it, old stock Canadians do. The movement from one party to the other is only slightly more amplified among so-called ethnic voters or immigrants and the children of immigrants voters. So what we're seeing here is a pattern where, by and large, if the Conservatives are rising, they're rising a little more among ethnic voters than they are among longer established Canadians. And similarly, there are predictions that if there is a swing back to the Liberals this time around, it will be more a matter of a wide what they sometimes call a wave of voters generally going back to liberals, of whom some ethnic communities are a little bit more pronounced than others, some a little bit less. But by and large, I guess I find this heartening. The more people dig into the data, the more they find similarities in the voting patterns of new Canadians and older Canadians than they see differences.
All right, thanks. And people who want to read your stuff on the ethnic vote, go to mcleans.ca.
Yeah, so we've got some stuff on there, interesting stuff about, it seems like ancient history now, but centering on Justin Trudeau's big rally in Brampton, which is in the center of some of those sort of heavily immigrant ridings in the burbs of Toronto.
Excellent. All right, thanks very much. Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes, Maclean's Political Editor Paul Wells, and I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
Coming up after the break, we speak with an investigator about the official complaints being made in this campaign. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. In almost every election, candidates and regular voters see or experience things that may be illegal. The problems can range from sign vandalism to misleading robocalls, but no matter what it is, there are investigators tasked with looking into the complaints. Due to recent changes to our Elections Act, this time around those investigators fall under the control of the Commissioner of Canada Elections. To discuss what's been happening so far in this election campaign, I'm joined by the Chief Investigator, Eric Ferron.
First off, Eric, I guess the easy question is, how many complaints has the Commissioner's Office received so far in this election campaign?
So far, we got approximately 400 complaints.
400 complaints. Is that average? Is that high or low even? Where does that stand in terms of previous elections?
That's pretty much the same number as 2011. At this point in time in the election.
Are you expecting that number to get higher as we get closer to election day? I tend to notice in campaigns a lot of people tend to get a little bit more frantic when they see their party losing or another party ahead, and then issues sort of pop up out of that. Do you think that that complaints may rise as we get closer to E-Day?
Based on what happened in 2011, yes, we do expect to have a lot more complaints from now to the October 19th. And so the closer we get, the more complaints we get. And on the 19th, we'll have more on that day, too.
All right. So what did you see in 2011? How much did it increase?
Oh, actual numbers. The volume does go up, but I don't have the stats in front of me in terms of how exactly the percentage of increase. I can't tell you, but it does go up a lot the closer we get to the election.
Okay, so let's look at what types of complaints you receive. So what are the sort of things that you've been getting in from voters or campaign offices?
We get things like removal or vandalism of campaign signs, missing taglines on advertising, canvassers who want access to apartment buildings or condos. I guess that's pretty much, or advertising issues. So that's pretty much, I guess, what we're seeing right now.
And what sort of vandalism do you see? What are the common complaints you get for signs? Is it just spray painting over a sign? Is it ripping them out of the ground? What do you get?
We got pretty much all that. We have them, some of them are being stolen, some of them destroyed, some of them, things are plastered over them. A bit of everything, I would say.
Who are you getting the complaints from? Is it from the candidates themselves or mainly from Canadians and regular voters?
Both, I would say. Canadians, regular people who have their signs in front of their homes taken out will call us, or it can be the party or the campaign calling us for some of their bigger signs at intersections that they've seen being destroyed or vandalized.
Now, you talked to me about sign damage and vandalism as being one of the most common complaints, but one issue that really popped up in 2011 was the issue of robocalls. Have you received any complaints about phone calls being received or any misinformation being handed out to voters?
Again, I won't talk about the specifics of any complaints, but we do get calls about people receiving calls, and we encourage people to call us again if they believe that they've received a call misdirecting them. But we also see a lot of situations where people, I guess just to make sure, they'll let us know of some calls they've received. And it's for us to determine afterwards if it was if there was any intent there. But at this point, we don't really get into the specifics as to what exactly we've been receiving in terms of robocalls.
So you can't say if some of them are valid complaints or some of them are erroneous complaints, just regular calls that people just don't like?
Well, yes, some people just don't like the fact that they got a call, either a live call or a robocall. There is the requirement now with the changes to the Act that the callers need to register with the CRTC. They have a data bank of the ones who will make calls, and that's a tool that we have access to determine who was behind certain calls. It does help us in determining if the call was legitimate or not.
So if you found, you can't say whether you've found any legitimate complaints?
No, I won't say exactly if the complaints on robocalls are legitimate or not than what we've received.
Once you get these complaints, if you find out a complaint has some substance to it and there's an issue, what's the process then? Do you investigate it? And then if you believe that an election law has been broken, you pass it on to a different authority? Is it just passed on to the police? What's the process there?
Well, if we receive a complaint and we look into it, we find that there's been an infraction, and obviously that's it's severe enough that it warrants charges in the commissioner's mind. He will refer the matter to the Director of Public Prosecutions and for him to review, and he will let us know at that point if it's something that we can lay charges on or not. So that's the process. Is the commissioner will investigate, determine if it's something that he should be referring to the Director of Public Prosecution for charges, and it's for the Director of Public Prosecutions to determine if charges are to be laid or not.
What are the penalties for trying to, I don't know, deface a sign or do anything illegal like that?
Well, specifically on the destruction of signs, if somebody were to be found guilty of that, and that's just under our act, obviously there's the possibility of criminal code charges also, but just under the Canada Elections Act, if somebody were to be found guilty of that, there's a possibility of a fine of up to $5,000. They could also be in prison for a term of not more than 6 months or both.
That's pretty serious.
It is serious, yes.
What about some of the other complaints? I mean, you were talking about advertising. That would be an issue for the parties and the candidates themselves, right? So I imagine there would be different penalties for those complaints.
Exactly. There's different penalties depending on what infraction occurred. So depending if it's advertising from the parties or advertising from third parties, it will all depend on what type of advertising we're talking about.
That was Eric Ferrand, the chief investigator for the Commissioner of Canada Elections. Well, that's it for this week's episode. For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.